Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are wrestling with a really fundamental question, aren't we? Why are we who we are?
It's a big one.
Yeah. We're diving into this really brilliant way of thinking about identity from counseling psychologist Meetu Bisht, looking at the themes in her work, why we are who we are.
And it feels like an exploration that's, well, really needed right now. The mission here is pretty clear. Let's try to unpack this complex tapestry, you could say, of identity.
Tapestry, I like that.
Yeah, our biology, our environment, and maybe most importantly, our conscious choices. We want to help you understand what makes you, you know, distinct from all those forces that shaped you.
And I think the reason it matters so much now is that feeling of being stuck. So many people feel trapped in patterns that don't even feel like their own. It's this profound sense of self-alienation.
Oh.
So this work, it isn't just about figuring things out. It's aimed at transformation.
Mm-hmm.
Moving you, the listener, from feeling like maybe a passive product of your past to becoming an active architect of your future self.
Right.
That's the goal.
That's absolutely the goal. And well, that journey really starts with understanding our guide here, Meetu Bisht. She's a distinguished counseling psychologist, really known for her deep, empathetic look at the human psyche.
And specifically within the modern Indian context, which is important.
Very important context. She explores how identity operates there with all its unique challenges.
But she's not just theorizing, is she? It's the mix of her clinical work and the science that makes it feel so grounded.
Absolutely right. Her earlier work, The Subdued Self, which got a lot of attention, looked at how societal pressures, patriarchal structures, often force us to suppress our authentic selves.
Hmm.
And she's seen the impact of that, you know, day in and day out in her practice for years. That's why she can weave together things like neuroscience and cultural anthropology with genuine practical wisdom. She bridges that gap between academic ideas and, well, the messy reality of how we actually live.
Okay, so let's get into the core idea then.
Mm-hmm.
Bisht argues that identity isn't this fixed thing you just sort of find.
No, not at all. It's dynamic. It's an evolving process. She talks about it as an emergent property, something that arises from complex systems interacting.
And she uses that tapestry metaphor you mentioned, woven from three threads.
That's right. Three key threads constantly interacting. First, there's the innate blueprint, that's our nature, our biology.
Okay.
Second, environmental conditioning, that's the nurture side, especially family and culture. Big influences there.
Huge. And the third?
And third, conscious choices. That's our agency, our ability to choose.
That tapestry idea is helpful.
Mm.
But where does she land on that classic nature versus nurture debate? If our biology and environment are, say, the marble we start with, are choices really strong enough to reshape it? How much sculpting can we actually do?
That's really the central question she tackles. She shows us that, yes, the marble has certain properties, certain limitations, maybe, but the sculptor that's us still has significant creative power.
Okay.
The structure of her framework itself is like a journey. You start with the foundations, genetics, neuroscience, even back in the womb. Then you move through early relationships. Attachment is key there.
Right.
Then it expands out to the social womb, family, culture. And finally, she gives us tools for transformation, things like mindfulness, rewriting our internal stories.
It sounds like it's really, for anyone who's ever felt stuck or questioned why they react certain ways automatically or just wants a deeper connection with their, you know, authentic self.
Definitely. That tension between who we feel we should be and who we are, that's the landscape she maps out. So let's unpack these threads a bit more, starting with that innate blueprint.
Nature versus destiny. The old debate.
Exactly. But Bisht says genes give us a draft, maybe a temperament, a predisposition towards certain things, but they are absolutely not destiny. It's not set in stone.
And this is where the science gets really interesting, right? She brings in epigenetics.
Yes. This idea is fascinating. It's about how our life experiences, things like diet, chronic stress, trauma, can actually flip genetic switches on or off.
Without changing the underlying DNA code itself.
Precisely. So the stress you experience, maybe from constantly worrying about what other people think, log kaya kahenge, that what will people say, fear, It isn't just psychological.
It's physical.
It can have physical consequences, yeah. It can revise your biological script over time. The environment literally edits the draft biology gave you.
Wow. So biology isn't fixed, it's dynamic.
Right.
That's a really powerful shift in thinking.
It really is. And building on that, she stresses how crucial early life is. Which brings us to attachment and what she calls the internal working model.
Formed by those very first relationships.
Exactly. She draws heavily on attachment theory. That first bond with a primary caregiver creates this blueprint, this model inside us.
And that model shapes our expectations for future relationships and our self-worth.
Absolutely. If your early experience taught you, say, I need to cling tightly or I'll be abandoned, that's the anxious style, right? You'll approach relationships very differently than someone whose model says, people are generally reliable and I'm worthy of love, which is the secure style.
And the other styles.
Avoidant.
Right. There's dismissive avoidant, kind of pushing intimacy away, and fearful avoidant, which is a confusing mix of wanting closeness but being terrified of it.
Just identifying your style seems like a huge step. It helps you see relationship patterns not as personal failings but as, well, learned responses.
Exactly. It fosters self-compassion. Oh, that's my old model firing. It's not me, fundamentally.
Hmm.
Okay, so moving outward from that core attachment, the next thread is woven by what she calls the family factory.
The family factory. Okay. This uses family systems theory. Right. Viewing the family not just as individuals, but as this interconnected emotional system.
And in that system, to keep things stable, we often get assigned roles or fall into them without even realizing it.
Yes. Think about those common roles. The hero child, the scapegoat, the peacemaker, the lost child.
Mm-hmm.
Bisht shows how these roles, which might have been necessary for survival within the family system, become like invisible uniforms we keep wearing into adulthood. They dictate the unwritten rules about who we think we're allowed to be.
Even long after we've left home. Wow.
Yeah. And then the conditioning broadens out even further into the weight of culture. This is where her insights into the Indian context, for example, are so sharp. How cultural scripts act like this invisible sculptor.
You mentioned Sanskar earlier, the moral upbringing idea, and that constant internal echo of what will people say. Log Kakahenj.
Exactly. That fear of external judgment becomes internalized. It becomes a major driver of behavior. And this, she argues, often creates the subdued self.
The subdued self. The version of us that prioritizes fitting in, keeping harmony, fulfilling perceived duties, maybe over our own genuine feelings or desires.
That's it, precisely. And maintaining that subdued self, that facade, is exhausting. Mm-hmm. It creates this internal split, this chasm you mentioned, between who we pretend to be and who we really are deep down. That's often where anxiety and depression take root.
Yeah, it makes so much sense.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we keep this subdued self going even when it hurts? How does the internal machinery work?
Well, that's where she pivots to the mind's architecture, how we often unconsciously maintain these patterns. She talks about schemas.
Schemas. These aren't just beliefs, are they? They're deeper.
Much deeper. They're like core filters that structure our reality. Think, I must be perfect, or I'm inherently flawed, or the world is dangerous. They determine what information we even let in.
So they filter out anything that contradicts the core belief.
Often, yes. Yeah. Or we distort the information to fit the schema, and that leads directly to cognitive distortions, faulty thinking patterns.
Like black and white thinking. Or jumping to the worst possible conclusion, catastrophizing.
Exactly. Those distortions are fueled by and reinforce the negative schemas. It's a cycle.
But maybe the most relatable part of this internal world is the inner critic, that voice.
Oh, yes. Everyone knows that voice. Bisht has a really helpful way of personifying it. She says it's not your conscience guiding you toward good.
It's not. What is it then?
It's a faulty survival mechanism, an echo from the past. It's often the internalized voice of critical parents or teachers or just societal judgment.
Like a ghost you said earlier.
Yeah, a ghost from the past. That moment you catch yourself saying something harsh to yourself and you realize, wait, that sounds exactly like my dad or whoever it was. That realization is powerful. That's not even my voice.
Okay, so that's the machinery.
Yeah.
Schemas, distortions, the inner critic. But she offers a way out, right? A path to freedom.
Yes, absolutely. And this is where it becomes really practical. The key tool she emphasizes is mindfulness. She calls it the power of the pause.
The power of the pause between the trigger and the reaction.
Precisely. It's about creating a tiny bit of space. So something happens, a trigger, like that critical email you mentioned, or someone cutting you off in traffic.
Okay.
And normally there's an automatic conditioned reaction. Anger, self-blame, whatever your pattern is. Mindfulness helps you insert a pause right there.
Just a moment to notice.
Just a moment to notice the trigger, notice the urge to react without automatically reacting. In that tiny space, that pause, that's where freedom lies.
Freedom to choose a different response.
Exactly. To choose a response aligned with who you want to be now, not just repeat the old programming, to replace autopilot with intention.
That transition from automatic reaction to conscious choice really seems to capture the essence, which brings us nicely to the key themes or messages from her work.
Yeah, the first big theme is what we could call the nature-nurture tango, understanding this constant dance between our biology and our environment. It should lead to self-compassion.
How so?
Because you realize your struggles, your anxieties, your patterns, they're often learned adaptations, ways you survived. They aren't necessarily signs that you're fundamentally flawed or broken.
Okay, that takes some pressure off.
A lot of pressure. It reframes the whole thing. And that compassion is crucial for the second theme, the conflict of self.
The gap between the subdued self and the authentic self.
Right. Bishter argues that so much psychological distress, anxiety, depression, that feeling of emptiness comes from that painful gap between who we're conditioned to be, who we think we should be.
And who we genuinely are deep down. What we really feel and want.
Exactly. So the work isn't about becoming perfect. It's about integrating those two parts, bringing them closer together, healing that split.
Integration, not perfection. That's important.
Very. And the third key message, maybe the most empowering one, our thoughts are not facts.
That's a classic cognitive behavioral therapy idea too, isn't it?
It is, and she really emphasizes it. Negative thoughts, that inner critic's voice, they're usually just mental habits, echoes of old conditioning. They feel true, but they aren't necessarily objective reality.
So the goal is to learn to observe them without automatically buying into them.
Yes. To see them as mental events, like clouds passing in the sky, rather than absolute truths about who you are. That observation creates distance, and in that distance, you reclaim your mental sovereignty. You choose what to believe.
Her work is also filled with these really vivid metaphors, isn't it? Things that stick with you.
Absolutely. They make the idea so much more tangible. Like the first one about agency. She puts it something like, we are sculptors working with the marble of our inheritance and environment.
Right. Acknowledging the material we're given, the genetics, the upbringing, we can't change that marble.
No, but the quote emphasizes that we are the sculptors. We still have a meaningful ability to shape what we become. We can create something beautiful, even unique, from the material we have.
Okay, that's hopeful. What about the inner critic one?
That one's powerful, too. Paraphrased, it's like, your inner critic is not your conscience, it is your fear. True wisdom is in turning on the light to see it's just a shadow.
Framing it as fear, not wisdom or truth. That changes its power, doesn't it?
Instantly. If it's just a shadow, just fear projected, you can learn not to be ruled by it. You can see it for what it is.
And the third one connects directly to mindfulness.
Yes. The one about the pause. Between the event and your reaction lies a sacred space. In that space lies your freedom to choose who you want to be.
That's the whole practice in a nutshell, really.
Yeah.
Find the space. Use the freedom.
Exactly. It makes the abstract idea of choice very concrete and actionable.
So moving from the ideas to action, how can listeners apply this tomorrow? What are some real life applications?
Well, one really practical thing is to use the attachment framework to map your blueprint, as she might say. Try to identify your own patterns in relationships.
So notice, do I tend to get really anxious and clingy when I feel insecure? That might be anxious preoccupied.
Right. Or do I tend to shut down, pull away, need space when things get intense? That could be dismissive avoidant.
And just recognizing that pattern helps you step back from it.
It really does. Instead of thinking, there must be something wrong with me, or this relationship is doomed, you can think, okay, my old attachment model is getting activated here. What's a more secure, constructive way I could respond now? It depersonalizes the conflict.
That makes sense. What about for parents?
Huge implications for better parenting. If you understand secure attachment, you can consciously practice being sensitive and responsive to your child's needs, even when it's hard.
And maybe break cycles. If you grew up in a family where emotions weren't discussed, you could consciously choose to model emotional expression for your kids.
Exactly. You can actively choose not to pass down the suppression or the insecurity you might have learned. That's incredibly powerful generational change.
And professionally.
At work.
The inner critic work is key for tackling things like imposter syndrome, that feeling of, I don't belong here, I'm going to be found out.
Yeah, that's a common one. So when that voice pipes up before a big meeting or presentation, you can learn to recognize it. Ah, there's the critic. That's the old fear talking, the old not good enough schema.
Not objective reality about your competence.
Not objective reality. Recognizing it as just the critic's voice, a ghost from the past, can free you up to actually take healthy risks, own your accomplishments, and not be paralyzed by that fear.
It feels like this whole framework offers a real shift in how we understand ourselves. A paradigm shift, maybe?
I think so, towards integration, towards wholeness.
For me, the biggest takeaway is definitely that move away from self-criticism, that default question, what's wrong with me, or why am I like this? Bitch's work encourages a different question, doesn't it? A much more compassionate one. What happened to me? What did I learn from it? Or maybe, what patterns did I develop to cope with what happened?
Yes, that shift from blame to understanding, from criticism to curiosity and compassion, it changes everything. It opens the door to actual change rather than just beating yourself up.
Absolutely. What's the lasting insight for you?
For me, it's the profound idea that identity truly is an ongoing journey. It's about integration and wholeness, not about reaching some static state of perfection.
Always evolving.
We're complex adaptive systems, always learning, always integrating. And the really deep realization is that even though these forces, biology, family, culture, are incredibly powerful in shaping us,
Yeah.
we still possess these tools: mindfulness, conscious choice, the ability to rewrite our narratives. We have agency. We can participate in our own becoming. The goal isn't flawlessness. It's about becoming more whole, more authentically ourselves.
A roadmap for becoming the self you truly want to be. That's incredibly valuable. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Accatra Foundation.